From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining, and if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware Peake, and this morning we speak first with Harvard University science historian Rebecca Lamov. She'll talk to us about brainwashing, mind control, and hyper-persuasion. And guess what? It's not about just those who are vulnerable to joining cults. It is all of us. And then, is it really possible to change your entire personality in a year? An award-winning science journalist experiments with her own personality to find out and reveals the science behind lasting change. That all coming up this hour on Cool Science Radio. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words. Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
And I'm Katie Mullally.
Our next guest, Rebecca Lamov, is a historian of science at Harvard University and has been a visiting scholar at the Max Planck Institute. Her research explores data technology and the history of human and behavioral sciences. Today, she brings us one of the most important topics of our time. It's about the instability of truth. That's also the name of her new book. It's about brainwashing, mind control, and hyper-persuasion. And guess what? It's not just those who are vulnerable to joining cults or going down the rabbit hole of conspiracy theory. It is all of us. Even, she will tell us, how she found herself a little brainwashed for a period of time. Rebecca, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks so much for the chance to talk with you.
I'd love to start off with, there's this word indoctrination, and then there's this word brainwashing. And I think that in some ways they're similar, but they're also very different. Could you distinguish the two and maybe give us your take on brainwashing if we're all vulnerable to it?
Thank you. That's a great question. I mean, I think of indoctrination as a process of political molding or shaping. Tends to have to do with the realm of ideologies, and it's very much related to brainwashing. But what I find interesting and why I've written about brainwashing and not indoctrination per se is that I find brainwashing a more complex and paradoxical and self-involving process. So you could look at the way the simplest synonym for brainwashing might be something like coercive persuasion. And if you just break that down a little bit, it's about coercion, so it's about a process that's imposed upon people, but at the same time, it's also persuasive. It's not simply coercion. It's not simply brute force or brutality or a forced kind of indoctrination, but it's actually, at some point, a persuasive buy-in, or there's a yes, even if it's in a very dark situation where a person is agreeing simply to save their lives, there has to be an element of subjective entry into the process. And I think that's what makes it particularly painful sometimes and fascinating, and also something to which we're all potentially subject.
Yes, and I don't mean to single you out, but because you start your book with a story about how even you, someone who's very well educated, someone who has been studying mind control and brainwashing for over a decade, and now writing this book on it, and you teach a course on it, you found, I think it was back when you were in graduate school, this your own kind of personal story about brainwashing. And I think it's important because we all, I don't know, it kind of brings into what we're passionate about and what we sometimes are so passionate about that we find ourselves almost brainwashed to continue to believe in it, whatever this passionate thing is. Can you talk about your story?
Yeah, that's a great way of framing it. I mean, one part of the story is that I went to graduate school because I was just passionately curious about questions such as, who are we? You know, the kind of, I had moved to California after college, and what does it mean to be a person, a certain kind of person? Would I be a different person if I had been raised in an entirely different culture by different parents or under altered circumstances. So it seemed to me that I could ask these profound questions if I entered into anthropology, the social sciences. Perhaps I would journey far away, but I ended up studying the behavioral sciences. And actually, as it happened, I found fascinating this kind of set of very advanced theorists who were arguing, you know, French theorists like Derrida and the deconstructionists who were very fashionable in the 1990s when I was in graduate school. And they wrote things that seemed to offer, you know, profound answers to these questions of who we are, what, how society, culture, power, politics operate. But I noticed among my group of students that we all were kind of vying with each other to say more and more advanced things and to write in this kind of language. And after a while, it did transform the way I was writing. I received praise the more difficult and the more difficult to understand it seemed that the work was. People kind of started to speak in that new language. And it was almost like a spell had been cast on us. And later I gave one of my papers, of which I was very proud, and I'd received lots of praise. Like this, you know, even another student said, I can't really understand this, but I took that as kind of, you know, it must be very advanced. But a friend of mine said, this just doesn't sound like you. It didn't. And I realized that step by step in little ways, I mean, later when I look back on it, I thought there are certain similarities with these processes that seem much more extreme, called brainwashing. And I sort of started to entertain this playfully, like, are there ways in which in our personal lives we do come to embrace things that are not ourselves? And what does that mean? And can it take a darker turn?
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with author Rebecca Lamov. She is a historian of science at Harvard University and has written a new book, The Instability of Truth. Well, we're talking about brainwashing, and I think so many of us assume that brainwashing is, you know, like the Jim Jones cults and these big cults and these big indoctrinations. But do you see brainwashing at a personal level, especially with social media and all of the algorithms that determine what we see, that continually reinforce a message? Does that count?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm arguing in the book. And because I basically wrote the first two thirds of the book about what you would call extreme situations, and it was quite heavy material. I tried to locate in the stories of POWs and people inducted or into cults, and also soldiers who underwent these severe processes of anti-brainwashing, I try to locate the kind of ordinariness in their experiences and ways that we can try to understand what those processes were like, because I think they are relevant to what each of us experiences today, which is basically an ongoing experiment in a kind of minor and major shocks to the system. And the theme that I identify that kind of unifies all these experiences is the idea of ungrounding, which is something I kind of bring to the conversation in the history of brainwashing, which is before any of the techniques are put in place, there's really a sense of profound ungrounding, which I define as a process of sustaining successive shocks to the point of disorientation. And that could be, you know, your 17-year-old GI sent to Korea from upstate New York. You've never left the country. You don't even know what you're fighting for. And you find yourself, you know, after a certain amount of time in a thought reform prison camp. You know, that would be ungrounding. But it's also ungrounding to be making everyday tiny decisions that seem meaningless and yet which amount to a kind of structuring of our experiences. So I think that the thread of ungrounding is something that unifies all these episodes.
Well, and ungrounding, you know, the more you think about it and the more you read into this book, you find that this term ungrounding, which I like that better than brainwashing, because I think we can all relate to that. I mean, it happens everywhere, from advertisements that we see to Facebook posts that we follow to what our friends are saying. How can we notice those moments of ungrounding, or all of those, you know, opportunities to not be ungrounded?
Yeah, that's a great way. I mean, thank you for pointing that out. I think it relates to the title of the book, which is The Instability of Truth, by which I mean not that we're beyond truth or we've passed truth or we're post-truth, but really that we're just in a condition where the truth is unstable or differentially available at different times. So if we're in an ungrounded condition, what are things we can do? There's one parable I like to use for myself, which is basically the hero of this book, or someone who really inspired me, is the Polish poet Czesław Miłosz, who was also a dissident who left communist Poland in the 1950s, in 1953. And he tells the story of why he ultimately left, because he didn't want to. He found himself in a situation after World War II where he and all his friends were, you know, in order to make a living, in order to continue to write, which was the most important thing to him, he had to change how he thought about the system he was living in, which he called the new faith. He had to adopt this new faith, but not like you could adopt it on the surface and then secretly believed what you really believed. But after a while, if you actually wanted to be a poet, you had to think in a new way. And he found himself. So he tells a story. He says, he calls it the parable of the frogs, where, you know, say you're someone tells you that you need to eat live frogs in order to be healthy. And the first day you happily eat the frog, but it didn't taste that good, but you convince yourself that it's good for you. And you continue on with enthusiasm to eat the second frog. And then it's quite repulsive. And this is somewhere between the second and the third frog, he realized that he couldn't eat anymore. And he called it a revolt of the stomach. And he says, it's not that I thought, or intellectually I was superior or had a better way of looking at it. I just couldn't eat any more frogs. And he ultimately left and ended up in California, teaching at the University of California, Berkeley, which he also didn't find to be a paradise. But at any rate, I thought it would be interesting to think of ourselves as between the second and third frogs sometimes. And, you know, just notice, I think it's about noticing. And what's been really helpful for me is just trying to introduce some space between what we're exposed to, the stimuli, and the way we respond. So it's not so much, I have to turn off all electronic media, I have to do X, Y, or Z, but at what point does my stomach begin to revolt, even in a minor way? You know, just paying attention to almost these gut, you know, these just sensations or things that might cause us to pause and reflect. And also, I think the second part is being aware that this isn't something that only affects other people, because it's easy to feel that way. Like that whole section, all of those people have become completely brainwashed, but rather it's something that we're all in together.
Yeah. Rebecca, you know, you mentioned that strange sex cult Nexium, which I think I've heard several podcasts about it. I just thought it was so interesting how it started off to be, and as many things do, you know, there are positive aspects of it. I think this was like a leadership group. Mm-hmm. And I ended up watching the TED Talk, which is a great companion to your book in a way, mm-hmm. of Sarah Edmondson, is that her name, a Canadian actress who is heavily involved in Nexium. And she points out a lot of the ways that things start out good and you find yourself getting kind of sucked into it because of its goodness. And like you say, at what point does, you know, it's very different for various people. At what point it's between the second and third frog, you know, and our stomachs revolt. Claire Bronfman, who's in that very famous family, Bronfman, and it was all over the news. She ended up going to jail, I think, for being a part of this whole Nexium cult thing. Her father, she had talked him into attending one of the meetings, and he immediately said, this is BS. I am, you know, I'm not taking part in this. So what is the difference in someone like him versus someone like his daughter who went all the way with it?
No, that's a really profound question. And I think, so interestingly enough, the great brainwashing experts of the 1950s then went on to become the great cult experts of the 1970s. They're the very same people. And that's because these ideas and psychodynamics and social dynamics apply. It's a really deep question, I think, of how someone gets inducted or joins a cult, because a lot of it has to do with happenstance. And I think one reason that there is no, even among the greatest anti-cult warriors and, you know, therapists and deprogrammers, there's not a single list of abusive cults, simply because different groups affect different people differently, just like drugs in a way. So it can, in my experience, and what's sort of fascinating and why those cult documentaries are so fascinating, is this kind of dizzying sense that, oh, if I hadn't just broken up with my boyfriend and been particularly vulnerable or been worried about, you know, had imposter syndrome in my PhD program, and I found it very empowering to do these breathing exercises, but I didn't know you're often working in a situation of unevenly distributed information, or information is hidden from you initially when you join a group. There are layers. And so a lot of it, more than we like to think, is happenstance and stage of life. And often, you know, more intelligent, open-minded, and idealistic people can sometimes be more vulnerable to a cult just because they're open to a message that things could be otherwise, the world could be transformed. And many cults' messages are these quite idealistic, slogans.
Right. So your message in your book, The Instability of Truth, is really about how we all should recognize these traits in ourselves, and how we should not, you know, just put these tendencies on other people who we know, who may constantly be signing up for a multi-level marketing program, to QAnon, to Flat Earth, to, you know, whatever it is that seems so obvious, cult-like. What is the byproduct of us not buying into our own brainwashing that you're hoping to set in motion?
Well, I think that the stakes are large, although they may seem small. We all, you know, are potentially subjected. We're all familiar with doom scrolling, or feeling quite alienated, being somehow aren't seeing ourselves, our children, you know, being lost in these digital environments. But to see that not only are these both small, but they're also paradoxically very large. And the extent to which we constantly attribute these and segment off, the history shows that there's just a consistent pattern of not understanding. Like even I mean, this is why I put myself in the book. I do this constantly. If I hear about some new scam that some poor person was subjected to, I think, when I hear it, I think, at what point would I have been smarter? I would have known that was an FBI, not an FBI agent or whatever. I wouldn't have thought Keith Raniere was very handsome. But do we really know ourselves? Do we know what we're capable of? Because all the, you know, Sarah Edmondson thought the same thing. People who were POWs thought the same thing. And when they came out, they said, Patty Hearst is another example. She said, no one will understand. No one will ever understand what I've been through. And she was right. No jury did understand what she had been subjected to and what she'd had to do to save her life. So I think trying to tune in to that capacity and see it as a commonality, not a dividing or polarizing trait, is what I hope to communicate.
Well, and I think you, Rebecca, you bring up a good point there, is that the instability of truth, I mean, short of, you know, scientific truths, I think truth can be very malleable, and it, so much of it depends on our own perspectives. What did you see? What was your angle? What was your lived experience? And so how can we better understand truth in terms of it being not just a binary issue? It's not just a black and white. I guess what I'm saying is, how can we approach things and not just say, well, they're wrong because that's not my truth? How do we better understand a general definition of truth?
Right. So that's, I mean, not to succumb to an utter relativism of truth is a problem that might seem to arise from looking at the history here, and from the fact that people fall into all kinds of beliefs. And who's to say that's not their truth? But I mean, I go with Max Weber here, who said that ultimately science can only answer your questions so far. And his famous and moving speech that he gave at the end of his life, he said, science can answer your questions up to a point, but ultimately, you know, what are we, who are we, and how are we to live can only be answered with reference to ourselves. That doesn't mean that truth is relative, but it does mean that there's different types of truth. There are absolute questions we can only answer for ourselves about enduring values. But I think in the realm of the day-to-day and that which we're presented with, it's great. It's helpful to understand that, for example, that science itself is made up of a constant effort. It's not a single foundation that's unchanging. I'm in the field of history of science, and this is the one finding you see is that science is made. It's something that's constructed by human beings. Sometimes they're wearing slippers when they're doing it. It yields an edifice, but that edifice is made over time. It changes over time. So the things that we find solid are actually, when you examine them, they're the processes produced by humans. And I think just to the extent you can tune into that process, it's helpful, even if it seems destabilizing.
Well, how can we help those of our friends and our loved ones that we see so often that their truth, quote unquote truth, is so far in a different direction and they've been ungrounded and even brainwashed? How do we help them come back to a center and start to open their minds to other truths, if you will?
Well, you could look at the history of, I mean, I think relevant here is, I mean, is the history of cult deprogramming. So this was still going on today, of course, but in the 70s, there was this real kind of worry by upper middle class parents who were seeing their college age kids, younger kids sometimes disappear into cults. And no matter what their entreaties, it was impossible to argue their kids back or even to insist, you know, to undo those beliefs, no matter how hard you try. And ultimately, it's kind of up to the other person. There was some success found in deprogramming, but this was actually an illegal form of, you know, kidnapping the child, subjecting them to alternative beliefs, and sometimes locking them in a room for 48 hours or whatever, and sealing the windows. There is no way to change somebody else's mind. There are persuasive methods you can employ, but I guess that's why I think it's important not to exile the person to some other planet of like those who are subjected. Like if you're using brainwashing as an insult or as a way to create separation, I think that's a warning to oneself that it's probably not going to be successful, but just trying to find commonality, like in people I know who actually were in cults and who were able to leave them. And I'm not saying these cults aren't abusive and dangerous, because they certainly are. When they were able to leave, it was often that the whole programming was shattered simply by seeing their sister and realizing their sister loved them. Or, you know, or a happenstance in which a friend who maybe they've lost all their friends, but they run into a friend and they just, something they said somehow shatters this programming, which really can take hold. So anyway, I think being kind is the best way you can hope to influence someone.
So interesting, Rebecca. It's so simple, and yet it's so much not what we want to do when someone we're close to has been so obviously brainwashed, because we feel somehow that if we just love them and we're just kind to them, it's going to reinforce the idea that they're on the right track, right? That's why it's so hard to do, to just be kind and to love. Is there something along with being kind and loving that we can do that will make us feel more like, oh, I don't want to reinforce this behavior?
I mean, this interesting that what you're describing is a parallel to addiction, an addictive, a family member who's experiencing an addiction and, you know, having one's boundaries, I guess is the answer to that, or to the point. But I think it would depend on the situation so much, because I think from my own experience, and here I'm speaking not so much as a historian or a professor, but just as a person, I find it most useful to look at myself. Like, what have I assumed about the nature of brainwashing, for example? I mean, can I put my own house in order? Also, can I try to understand the dynamics that might have led to that person being in that position or falling for that conspiracy theory or whatever it may be? And are there ways that I myself may be subject to them too? I think that can somehow lessen the problem, which deeper than any of any particular nefarious theory or politician is this extreme polarization and mistrust we have in our country.
Yeah. Well, I have one final question. This is around the media, journalism. The thing that I say to people when I see them going off on these really fringy kind of media sources, whether it's left wing, right wing, my common or antidote, excuse me, is to say we all need to have two media sources that are one left of center, one right of center, that are the most longstanding, credible sources, left of center, right of center. Can you expand on that so I can, I mean, I don't know if that's a faulty thing to say or not.
I like that advice. I mean, I think that makes a lot of sense to me. One thing I recommend is to examine the extent to which you are, I know each of us is siloed in our news. It's so easy for that to happen. And algorithmic sorting tends to reinforce that, you know, that isolation. So if you're, I mean, many studies have shown how if you don't take efforts to teach your social media platforms or your news sources the things, not only what you like, but what, you know, what a range of interests, it will increasingly maximize certain qualities like engagement and often negativity. So I think having different news sources, recognizing that we're in a very unstable news environment, I mean, it's quite extraordinary shift from the world. And I think I was brought up in that, you know, a broadcast of CBS News could attract fewer viewers than a certain podcast, a popular podcast run by comedians, like far fewer viewers, so that what was once broadcast is now narrowly received, and the narrow cast is now massively dispersed. So it's really a different situation. So I think we should, I mean, I can understand that's one of the reasons that we are, it seems confusing, but to create the goal of sort of disrupting your own silo, disrupting the echo chamber of oneself is a really good one. And that's what you suggested, I think, is really good advice.
Well, Rebecca Lamov is our guest, and she's a historian of science at Harvard University. And she has written a new book called The Instability of Truth, Brainwashing, Mind Control, and Hyper Persuasion is the tagline. Rebecca, it's such an interesting conversation, and we're so thankful you could join us on Cool Science Radio.
Thanks so much. I really enjoyed it.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Katie Mullally.
Is it really possible to change your entire personality in, say, a year? Well, the research is in, and it shows that you can, in fact, alter your personality traits by behaving in ways that align with the kind of person you'd like to be. It's a process that can make you happier, healthier, and more successful. But what's the science behind this? Joining us now is Olga Hassan, who underwent experiments on her own personality to find out, and she reveals the science behind the lasting change. We'll hear all about it. And also in her new book, Me But Better. Olga, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Let's start off with what personality really is. I mean, you start your book off talking about Freud and talking about sort of definitions of personality. And when you first decided to wander into this whole topic, what did you think the science was behind personality?
Yeah, so personality is really the thoughts, feelings, and behaviors that come most naturally to us or most reflexively to us. But the researchers who study personality change add a twist onto that, which is that personality also helps us achieve our goals. So in addition to just describing us, our personality traits actually help us get what we want. So if, let's say, you really want to make more friends, agreeableness, you know, the personality trait of agreeableness can help you achieve that. If you would really like to be happier, a reduction in the personality trait of neuroticism can help you get that. So it's sort of the, you know, it's both descriptive, but it's also active in that it helps you achieve what you want in life.
Okay, so you say this despite the fact that, for example, I would like to be a little more neurotic when it comes to organization. And yet what you would say by that definition is that I don't actually really want that, or I would be that. Is that right?
Yeah, so I would say you don't want to be more neurotic because that's not what the trait is that goes with organization. That's conscientiousness, and a lot of people want to be more conscientious. So that's totally a valid thing to want. That's one of the most common personality traits that people want to develop, is to be more conscientious so that they can be on time, achieve more, be more productive, be more organized. And it's not that you don't want it badly enough. It could be that you just don't know how to get there, or you need systems in place that will help you get to that higher level of conscientiousness.
You're just joining us on Cool Science Radio. We're having a conversation with Olga Hazan. She has written the new book, Me But Better, The Science and Promise of Personality Change. Well, Olga, one of the things I really love about this book is it talks about the core fundamentals of if you want to change. You know, it's easy to listen to the podcasts and the protocols and all the new behaviors that we want to implement, getting up early, whatever it is. But unless our personality matches that, I'm not going to wake up early unless I consider myself to be a morning person. So how is it that the idea of personality really seems to have been left out of the conversation for so many years in terms of like optimizing yourself?
Yeah. So a lot of the things that we do think of as self-improvement is actually personality change. So let's say you want to become a morning person. That would be a form of personality change. So very conscientious people do tend to be morning people. They tend to get up earlier and get places early. To do that, you would kind of start to develop your conscientiousness or increase on that trait. And that would be a form of personality change. Same with when people say, you know, I wish I was better at public speaking. That's kind of growing in extroversion or becoming more extroverted, which is another form of personality change. So I think, you know, our personalities, they're always changing. A lot of our goals to become a better person or, you know, get better at certain things requires personality change. We just don't normally think of it that way.
Well, and you're so right. I really hadn't thought of becoming a morning person as a personality change. I just thought it was a habit that I had to force onto myself. And that makes it an easier, more attainable thing to do. But let's talk more about personality change. I think a lot of us think that our personalities are set. However we were when we were young is how we're going to be when we get older. But how often do most healthy people let their personalities evolve throughout their lives?
Most people do end up changing throughout their lives, even if they don't really try to change. So we all naturally become different as we get older. We become less neurotic. We become more agreeable. We become less open to experiences. So we all kind of naturally evolve and change as we move through life. Life events also change our personalities in different ways. So even if you don't take on a big change project and try to become a morning person or try to do anything differently, you'll still become a different person over time. Of course, you'll still be recognizable to most people, and most people will kind of still get the same sense of you from one year to the next. But you yourself will notice changes, and other people around you will notice changes as well.
Okay, so Olga, just on, because we hit on the topic of being an early riser, you know, if we look at what research shows about circadian rhythm and things like that, if being an early riser is part of being conscientious, you know, for someone who really wants to change that aspect of their personality, but their circadian rhythm from birth, I mean, my two kids from birth, they slept in longer than all the other kids when we went camping, they stayed up later. And I'm just wondering how that plays in.
Yeah, so your circadian rhythm is definitely something that determines how early you'll want to naturally wake up. I actually really empathize here because I am a super late riser, and I am also very conscientious. So essentially, whenever I have somewhere to be early in the morning, my conscientiousness is really pushing me to get there right on time, not be a minute late, even if that means waking up way too early for me, like 5:30, 6 a.m. That's not my hour at all. But, because I am really conscientious, I end up setting multiple alarms. I make sure I go to bed nice and early the night before. I drink my sleepy time tea. I do everything that I need to set myself up so that I can wake up early and, meet my goal of being places on time. So, though it would be much easier for me if I was, had the circadian rhythm of being an early riser, I'm not. But my personality, my conscientiousness, and more importantly, my goals of being timely, are so much more important to me that I'm willing to kind of push against my natural circadian rhythm in that way.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, if it becomes important enough to you. Like I, for example, my social life is severely impacted, and I don't even know when the last time I went to a concert, what, like a music concert, because I cannot stay up late at night, or I tell myself I cannot stay up late. If it were really important, I would do all these things like you do to change, your wake-up time so that I could stay up later and have a more robust social life and know a little bit more about music. I wanted to ask you about these personality tests like Myers-Briggs, which I feel like have been pretty discredited in recent years because, well, and I'm going to ask you why you think that is. And I think it may be because it's too pigeonholy, like, oh, I'm an ENTP, so I can or can't do XYZ.
Yeah, too pigeonholy is exactly right. So there is some validity to the Myers-Briggs. Introversion and extroversion is a component of it, and those are real personality traits. That's part of the Big Five as well, which is more kind of scientifically valid. What most researchers don't like about the Myers-Briggs is that it does put people into categories. Like you just said, most people get like a readout that's like ENTJ or something like that. But really, most of us don't fit into categories. We are all on a spectrum of all the traits. You might be 30% introverted, or you might be, 70% agreeable. But you're not going to be just like, oh, I'm very disagreeable in every situation, and I, never act in an agreeable way. That would be really very strange. So most researchers like to think of it as moving along a spectrum rather than fitting into a certain type of category.
Olga, we talked about neuroticism and conscientiousness, and those are part of the five big traits. Tell us about the five big traits, because how important is it to have these specific components of our personality?
Yeah, so it's not that whether it's important or not, it's that we all have five traits to our personality. These are just the five components, the Big Five that make up every person's personality. So it's openness to experiences, conscientiousness, extroversion versus introversion, agreeableness, and neuroticism versus emotional stability. We all have those traits inside of us, and it just depends on how much of each we have.
Well, the foundation of this book is you taking a year to really evolve your personality, we'll say. How did you go about doing that? And why is it that you felt like you needed to change?
Yeah, the reason I felt like I needed to change was that I really was not happy. I wasn't enjoying my life or appreciating what I had. I would really focus on the negative things that happened to me as opposed to anything positive that happened on that exact same day, or even the positive elements of the negative things that happened to me. And I kind of just got locked in these negative cycles where I would kind of was always snapping between worrying about the past and worrying about the future rather than living in the moment. So I wanted to change that. And really, the science suggests that personality helps determine how happy we are and how, you know, our quote unquote well-being, according to science. And essentially the way that you change these personality traits is by behaving like the kind of person you'd like to be. So in the research, what the scientists do is they ask people, hey, do you want to change your personality? The, you know, study subject says, yes, I do. I want to become more extroverted. And they say, okay, for the next week, say hi to three people, go out to coffee with two people, go to a concert with one person, you know, do these activities that will kind of push you to be more extroverted. And then people kind of stack up more and more, I guess, like practice at having these new traits that they're working on developing. And after a time, that does kind of become your new personality because you actually are behaving that way. So that's kind of how the personality change actually happens.
So it's curious, and I want to dive a little deeper into your own, your self experiment, which is so great, actually, that you did that. And then you, and actually, did you decide to write on it before you started this year of personality change, or did the writing become after you had done it?
So I had done an article for The Atlantic where I work, where I kind of dabbled in this a little bit. But then I kind of felt like there was a lot more to say after I was done with the article, and I wanted to do more. So I was already somewhat familiar with the research when I embarked on the year, but I had not sort of done the year and then decided to write about it, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So taking on or acting as though you have these personality traits that you want to have sounds a little maybe too wishy-washy. And the reason I ask about this is that you, as someone who, like, you had a great job, you had a good relationship, but you just looked at things in this way that you weren't always happy. So when you told yourself that you were happy, you know, did it ever backfire? Like you were faking it to yourself too much?
Yeah, so I wouldn't say that a key to personality change is just to tell yourself that you're happy. I would say there are two traits that I worked on that increased my happiness level. One is extroversion, and extroverts do tend to feel happier, or people who at least behave in extroverted ways tend to feel happier. But the way to do that is not to sit at home by yourself and be like, I'm actually happy right now. It's to go out and connect with other people. So it's really the social connection component that is giving you that mood boost. And that's what I did. I did a lot of activities with and around other people. And that's what the research suggests people do if they want that kind of mood boost that comes from extroversion. The other thing that I did is a lot of mindfulness meditation. And that too, for people who are familiar, does not involve like sitting there going, I'm actually really happy. In fact, you're not actually even supposed to be striving for any particular mood state. You just kind of sit there and focus on your breath, and the mindfulness is kind of working in the background, and gradually kind of making you happier, but it's kind of more just making you better at regulating your emotions.
Olga, so much of what you did was truly stepping out of your comfort zone. And here in Park City, we have such a small life, if you will. It's winter and summer and skiing and biking. Well, what if we wanted to go make some big changes and explore other parts of the world or the country, but finding that you get so nervous about being in a different place? How can we step out of this comfort zone that we've been encased in for so many years in this little town and go out and explore and fully enjoy and experience new things, new places, and new people?
Yeah, it's funny. I think a lot of people would love to be skiing and biking. Actually, exercise and being outdoors is really good for you across all the personality domains. So I would say people there are way ahead of a lot of folks when it comes to especially things like openness to experiences. You know, a lot of the recommendations are like to get out and be active and stuff. So kudos there. I would say, though, that, you know, there's always, you know, opportunities to like learn from other cultures or other activities. And I would just dabble in something that feels super safe at first, but still different. So for me, I tried surfing to increase my openness levels. And I surfed in the easiest possible surfing waters. They were kind of these 6-inch maybe waves in Costa Rica, and it was the water was like the temperature of a bath, and it was completely see-through to the bottom. And we had a surfing instructor who was from the States, and we felt very, very there were 3-year-olds surfing kind of next to us. So that was our foray into trying something new, because though we wanted it to stretch us and push our limits and teach us something new, we didn't want to be so scared that we didn't enjoy it or recoiled.
Well, you also learned improv, which was surprising to think that that could be a really great way to expand your personality. So tell us about the yes and system that you learned.
So the yes and is just a kind of a staple of improv. Anyone who's been to an improv show is probably pretty familiar with this. And it's just this idea that to create the scene up on stage, the improvisational actors accept whatever their fellow actors said and add something else. So if I come at you to say, "Do you think that bear is running at us to attack us?" You say, "Yeah, and I think that means we better run even faster." So you kind of pick up what they're putting down and then go forward with it. And I found that that can be a really handy tool and strategy to learn for conversation in general, because something that was kind of keeping me from getting out of my comfort zone or meeting new people was that I didn't like how often conversations would kind of go in directions that I couldn't predict or that I couldn't control. And it was beneficial for me to have experience with something totally crazy happening up on stage and having to kind of run with it and yes and it, because I do that now in my conversations with everyday people. I'm just sort of like, yeah, totally, and it can really work. It can help deepen your conversations with others.
Yeah. Olga, I'm wondering as your year went on and as you tried all of these things like improv and surfing, and I'm wondering how the brain shifts. What happens to the brain? We know now that it's very malleable, but what's actually going on in there as you're going through this year of trying new things?
Yeah, so I didn't get into the neuroscience of it all. So I'm not a neuroscience, so I'm neuroscientist, so I'm not gonna kind of speculate on what happens in the brain. But what happens kind of psychologically or functionally is that as you notice you performing these new behaviors, going to improv and getting quite good at it, going to surfing and getting better and better at it, you kind of start to see yourself as that kind of person. So you start to, when you think about, am I extroverted? You're like, well, I don't know. I went to a party last week and I had coffee with those people and that was super fun. And I organized a, cleanup in the park and that was great. Maybe I am extroverted. And so you kind of, these kind of behaviors and activities and mindsets reflect back onto you and become part of your personality.
Okay, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So my 86-year-old mother is this amazing person. She will take on things that, like, most of us wouldn't even think about it. She'll look at her yard and say, and she'll envision a new flower bed and she'll just dig in and do it. Or she'll just paint a room in her house without even thinking twice about how hard it's going to be. Yet she is a complete homebody, and she, for example, has barely even left this country. This summer, she is coming on a trip with me to Norway. And I couldn't believe that she actually agreed to go. But I want to give her a tool because she doesn't envision herself as a traveler. She doesn't envision herself as someone who rides on planes. How can she make that transference of saying, like, oh, I am a person who will just dig into my landscaping, you know?
Yeah, that's so interesting. It's almost like advice for, well, without knowing her, I would kind of encourage her to think of the travel as just another challenge, like all the many challenges that she takes on, that, it's going to have a number of steps. You know, it's going to feel unfamiliar, but that you'll figure it out as you go along. I mean, it sounds like she's someone who really doesn't shy from doing things that are challenging and rewarding. You know, I would encourage her to see this as something else that is both challenging and rewarding, and that is possible to tackle incrementally.
Well, Olga, since it is a science and technology show, I want to ask about technology and its effects on our personality. What have you seen in your research and your own experience, the effects? So what effects have you seen, sorry, from the research, from your research and your own experience of social media on our personalities?
Oh, that's so interesting. You know, I'm really not sure, but I do feel like people are becoming less extroverted because social media is always at hand. And so you can kind of feel like you've gotten your social interaction or like you've gotten your fill of, you know, social connection through your phone, even though most scientists say that it's not quite the same thing and that, you know, poking at a screen for a bit isn't really the same as actually being around humans.
Well, what would you say would be the most important thing we can do to even just enhance and appreciate our own personalities as they are? Because I think a lot of us kind of pull back because we're like, oh, I don't know if people like me or I don't like myself. But what can we do to really let our true nature shine through?
Yeah. So I would think of this as liking yourself and using the tools of personality to enhance your life even more. So I would build on what you already have. I'm very conscientious. So I made, you know, Google calendars of all the activities I wanted to do. You know, I would build on your current strengths to achieve what you want to achieve through the tools of personality. That's how I would think about it. Not as liking or disliking yourself, but as seeing these as tools.
Well, our guest has been Olga Hassan. She has written a new book. It's called Me But Better, The Science and Promise of Personality Change. Olga, thank you so much for joining us today on Cool Science Radio. And I just have to ask you, do you consider yourself an extrovert now?
It's so interesting. I would say ambivert. I think I'm right on the midline. I think I have my little introvert moments and I have my times when I just need to leave the house because I'm going crazy.
Yeah, absolutely. I love it. Well, thanks so much. It's been fun talking to you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio here on KPCW. You can find this episode on kpcw.org under the Shows tab or on the KPCW app or wherever you get your podcasts at KPCW Cool Science Radio. And if you liked today's episode, rate us, subscribe to the show, and share it with your friends.